Welcome to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from the legendary hills of Brown.
Where the plum purple haze,
the one nature herself drapes over the hills and hollers,
inspires local characters, artists, and nature lovers.
It's as though the hills themselves conspire to create a beauty and a culture in the heart of Indiana.
Sit for a spell and hear the music.
The tall tales.
True stories.
And current goings on.
Brought to you by folks who still know how to sit by a fire in winter.
And swim buck naked in summer.
Welcome to episode 35 of the Brown County Hour. This is Dave Seastrom along with the rest of the crew.
This month's musical feature is the bluegrass band Hamilton Creek, and we'll listen to an interview with them along with a few of their musical selections. We'll also be sharing an interview with local character Harry Hopkin.
We have some commentary on the new forest plan from Rick Patrick. Don Crum from the Beta Teen Center shares some information about the Youth Showcase musical event. And Rick and Dave share another essay.
Carrie Ray shares another four song. Rachel Perry lets us in on what really happened between Wash and Mary Barnes. And we have a Valentine's poem from Gunther Flum.
We start the show with our interview with Hamilton Creek, followed by some of their music.
Rick Patrick states his views on the new forest plan, and we have Carrie Ray's latest contribution to For a Song.
My privilege to introduce Hamilton Creek, a local bluegrass band of some notoriety, and I'm going to let everyone introduce themselves and say a few words. Let's start off with Danny Harden.
Yeah, I'm Dan Harden. I've lived here all my life, and I've been around bluegrass all my life, and it's a privilege to play with these boys here. This is one fine bunch of guys that plays music too.
Hi, I'm Neil Smith. I was gone for quite some time, but I come back and these guys took me under their wing, and we're back playing some nice bluegrass.
I'm Dave Connor, and Dan here found me on Craigslist. He was desperate for a mandolin player, and so I kind of jumped right in there. It's been, 4 or 5 years now, and I enjoy playing music with these guys. They're really good.
I'm Frank Kellogos, and I'm the bass player, and I try to keep these guys all in time, and I keep the speed going the right time. I guess I've known Danny for a long time. Neil and Dave, I haven't known for a real long time, but we kind of get to go playing together, and we're doing pretty good music. Thank you, everybody's enjoying it. So,
well, I'm curious, where does the name Hamilton Creek come from?
Well, we used to have a different bass player. We didn't have Frank the Rock Kellogos. We had John Huber. His wife is my cousin. We were down there. We mainly jammed. We played around some, and we just happened to look out his window. He lives on Hamilton Creek. So we said, that's a good name. We'll just pick that name. That's how we came up with it.
So how long have you guys been playing together?
Dave and I have been playing together about 4 or 5 years. Frank and Neil, probably a year or two.
About 6 months. All four of us have been together.
All four of us.
Well, I've heard you've got a CD in the works.
We're working on it with my brother Doug. He has a digital studio in his basement.
If we want to hear your music, where's the next time you're going to play?
Right now, it's wintertime, so we're sort of slow, but every second Friday we play at the Martin Lodge in the Little Gym restaurant from 6 to 8. Well, I'll give you a little bit of history about myself.
Thank you.
I started playing when I was 12 years old, and my first banjo teacher was Dave Hedrick. His father had the radio and TV place on Old 46 across from the church that's out there now. And I was 12 and he was 13, and we've been best friends ever since. But he led me down the road to depredation. This is bad news.
But yeah, bluegrass will ruin you.
Yeah, it will. But after him, I took lessons from the great Roger Smith. Anybody knows anything about bluegrass in this part of the country, took lessons from Roger, and he played with Bill Monroe for about, I think, 10 years or something like that. And we all learned from him. He was the old taskmaster. First thing he asked me, I was 13, coming to his house. He lived on the west side of Columbus. He said, "Are you coming here because you want to, or is your dad and mom making you?" And I said, "Because I want to." And he just looked at me and said, "Sit down."
There you go.
Sit down.
Well, I know you guys have been around a long time. Surely you've spent plenty of time up there at Bill Monroe's, got to see some of the greats over the years.
Yes, I have.
You get to meet any of them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, all of them. You know, just ordinary people. They just got a job playing. But and besides that, since I'm retired as a building commissioner here, that's my new job. I'm going to help Dwight run the Bluegrass Festivals up there.
Oh, nice.
And Neil can tell you more about him than his daddy.
Oh, my dad played a banjo for several years, but Danny helped teach him too. My mom played stand-up bass, so I kind of come from a long line of bluegrass.
Got any Bill Monroe stories for us?
No.
Lester Flatt?
No, Lester wouldn't. I wasn't real close to him. Earl wouldn't say anything unless you hit him upside the head. He didn't talk much.
Is that right?
No, he didn't talk much. He just let his banjo do the talking.
Well, when you can play that good, you don't need to talk.
Absolutely. How about you, Dave?
My first love, believe it or not, was kind of like folk music, Peter, Paul, and Marionette. And I bought my first Martin guitar in 1970, and I still have it after all these years. But I found if you shake a tree, about 30 guitarists would fall out, and mandolin players were kind of few and far between. So I took up mandolin about 15 years ago, and I found it's easier to find a band to play with if you play mandolin as opposed to guitar. Now, I'm not taking anything from guitarists, so we've got a great one right here, but there's a lot of strummers, and there's not a whole lot of great pickers out there, let me put it that way. But I found my niche.
What about you, Frank?
I just started playing bass. My father-in-law bought this bass, and he told me to play it, and I played guitar some, and so I just started to teach myself how to play this bass, you know, and I got playing with some bluegrass players, and that's how I got playing bluegrass. My dad, he always played guitar, but he played a lot of country music. He used to play on the radio station in Charleston, Illinois, back in the 40s and 50s on Friday nights. And him, my father-in-law, he played music, so that's how I kind of got in playing music. And Neil and I both got a real good friend of ours that played mandolin, and his dad played fiddle, and they was from around Bean Blossom area, and that's how I kind of got into bluegrass. Playing with them guys.
Yeah, so on your new CD, I assume it's going to be bluegrass. Are these original tunes, or are you recording?
Some of them probably will be. You know, my dad wrote one, which we're going to play tonight, Pine Mountain. My dad wrote that.
Nice.
About my grandfather, and then it's going to mainly be we're traditional, man. You know, we got first love. We love the old Monroe and Flat and Scruggs and Larry Sparks. I don't know, that's just our first love that we like to do.
So you believe there's two kinds of music, country and western?
No. Country left the town a long time ago.
Well, now, there's country and then there's country.
Well, I've got a good friend, Larry Cordell, you know, that wrote Murder on Music Row and Highway 40 Blues, and he said country died about 20 years ago.
Well, thank goodness they made recordings so we can still
absolutely
enjoy it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, y'all have a website?
Not yet. We have a Facebook page, Hamilton Creek. But
okay. Well, let's.
We haven't got that far yet. You know, we're a little on the slow side. It seems like social media is about the only way to even talk to people anymore.
So, if we want to get a hold of you, we can go to your Facebook
page to get.
It's called Hamilton Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you guys coming in tonight. Can't wait to hear some of your music.
We appreciate you guys having us.
Well, thanks for having us.
Yes.
Since we're fairly new, this is a good outlet for people to know who we are.
Well, and we are delighted to provide that opportunity.
Well, just you can say that after you hear us play.
Fair enough.
This is a song, Pine Mountain, my dad wrote in 1979 about my grandfather that was a coal miner down in eastern Kentucky. So I like to play this for my dad. Mm-hmm.
Letcher County, he will tell, he will tell. Oh, Lord won't miss him when they lay him in the ground. And they're tearing Pine Mountain down.
My name's Rick Patrick. I'm an ISA certified arborist. I've been doing tree work for 38 years, and my experience is in the urban and commercial and residential landscape, not so much forestry, but ran into Rick at the local BP, and he just asked me for some of my thoughts on logging. And what I've thought about over the year is I can remember the bumper stickers that always said trees, America's renewable resource. And I agree with that to an extent, but only if you can equate a 200-year-old oak with a 201-year-old seedlings. And that's who's got 200 years to wait. The biomass of 200 seedlings doesn't even come close to equaling the biomass of one limb on a 200-year-old oak. So there's one thing I've always had an issue with. Also, you know, logging, we're only going to take specific target trees. Okay, I think that's good, but unfortunately, you're going to have to build a road into the trees, which disturbs a lot of the trees around it. Then, unless you're using a helicopter to cut and haul everything out, you're going to be dropping the trees onto other trees that maybe you're not harvesting and doing damage that way. You know, part of a healthy forest is logging. Well, you know, it's an active system. It's a dynamic system. It's not a stagnant system. So you have things that are living, you have things that are dying, and you have everything in between. To cut down trees and say that that's a good thing just doesn't make sense to me. You have dead trees, that's a good thing. That's habitat, for animals and insects. It's a food source. It's a time-release fertilizer. Trees, when they do hit the forest floor on their own, they're protection for seedlings coming up to keep away invasives and invasive species of plants and animals. I had an opportunity to work with some folks that had a watershed, a large neighborhood over in the Columbus area, and a logger was trying to sell them on the idea that they were going to have a definite fire hazard. They needed to start cutting down their trees right away. But the trees are one reason their lake is doing so good. It filters the water, keeps the silt out. And I asked them if he was concerned that it was a fire hazard. Is he planning on cleaning up all the tops and things? Is he going to haul that all off and or chip it and mulch it back into the woods as compost? Because actually you're creating a fire hazard, not preventing it. So those are some of my thoughts. I mean, I know we got to have paper. There are trees, we have white pines that grow really quick so that we have our paper, and there's intelligent ways to do it, and logging our forests is not one of them.
Welcome to For a Song. I'm your host, Carrie Ray, and today I'm coming to you from the cozy confines of my living room. Why the change of venue? Is it some mechanism to better create intimacy, to make me feel more comfortable and, as a result, more reflective or transparent? Ah, if only that were the case. I'm sitting here sipping a cup of steaming, honey-infused herbal tea. There's a fire in the little intrepid wood stove, spitting and crackling joyfully, and a hint of the earthy, singular scent of a wood fire fills the room. Light from two hanging lanterns does a lazy dance on the whitewashed wall across the room. A random snowflake floats and spins in the cool moonlight just outside the window, and a clear, glassy crust of ice lies over the lake just beyond. The whole scene is really rather the idyllic Brown County winter's eve. Save one thing. The loathsome, rigid shell of fiberglass mesh, staring down at me from high upon its perch of pillows. A cast running from my knee all the way out to the five determined little digits that wiggle in defiance now and then, just to prove they still can. It taunts me in my lack of mobility, snickers at my impeded sense of balance, scoffs at my pain. Maybe it doesn't scoff exactly, but I bet you get the idea by now. Which brings me to today's topic. For the story or message of a song to come across, the listener has to relate at some level, to get the idea, if you will. I don't want my listeners to have to work so hard to figure out what my song means that they have no energy left to figure out what it means to them. Many lyrical variables make a song more or less relatable. But for now, let's talk about our five senses. We'll leave the sixth for later. And I'd like to use the start of this segment to demonstrate what I'm talking about. You may have to go back and listen again, which you can do on my website or at browncountyhour.com. When you do, you'll notice that I described my surroundings with an ample complement of adverbs and adjectives that speak to the senses. Smells, sights, sounds, tastes, and even a hint of the tactile. Now, granted, I went a little overboard for effect, but I think you'll notice how easily you were able to plop yourself right here in my seat. Presented well, the sum of sensory detail transcends mere description and relates an experience. That sort of communication is one of the differences between the poetic and the pedestrian. Now, that's not to say that spending an entire verse describing your lover's eyelashes is an advisable approach. But I find that most fledgling writers err strongly on the side of too little detail. So I guess I'd rather you start by going overboard, if that's what it takes. When writing lyrics, I often indulge my penchant for being overly descriptive, knowing that I can and will dial it back as the song takes shape. By doing so, I'm able to push past the more obvious options to access something more unique. Try it. Take a minute, sit down and be still. Then describe your surroundings. Better yet, describe how you experience your surroundings. I think you'll find that in doing so, you will strengthen your powers of observation as well as your ability to relay what you experience. And you'll be well on your way to writing songs that better connect with your listener. I'm Carrie Ray. Join me next time on For a Song. If you have ideas, questions, or topics you would like to have covered on For a Song, please send them along. You can reach me via the contact page of my website, carrieray.com. That's CARRAY.com. Thanks for listening.
Now we pause for station identification.
Brown County Hour is underwritten by Riverlight Yoga, where you will find expert instruction in a completely equipped, newly enlarged studio. We offer a variety of classes with individual instruction a specialty. Gift certificates in any denomination are available. See riverlightyoga.com for full information.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org.
We start off with an interview with Harry Hopkins. Dave Seastrom has another essay, and we hear another musical selection from Hamilton Creek.
This evening, we have Harry Hopkins with us from Brockwood Farm. He's an entrepreneur, and some might even say an entremeneur. Harry, would you please tell us about the two products that you've developed and how they got started?
Well, sure. The first product is the Brockwood Stall Shifter. The Stall Shifter is a product that looks like a shopping cart with a motor on it, where the basket shakes back and forth and you shovel the contents of a stall floor into the basket and it shakes it, and the sawdust bedding that's in the horse stall falls through to the floor in a nice fluffy pile, all aerated and ready to reuse, and the manure falls off the end into the tub. That's what the Stall Shifter is. When my wife and I got horses, we thought it would be really easy. We learned very quickly that it took a lot of sawdust bedding to buy just to keep the stalls bedded nicely. And we also found out that the labor to clean those stalls every day was a lot more than we had ever planned on. Pretty soon, I had tennis elbow, she had shoulder and back problems. I said, there's got to be a better way to do this. I have an engineering background. I am kind of a make-do kind of guy, and I can put things together. And so we made our first stall shifter out of an old screen that I had found that had a stainless steel frame and stainless steel hardware cloth wire on it. And I took it into a stall that was particularly hard to keep clean because it had a miniature horse in there. And these miniature horses have tiny little poops, and they normally fall through the tines of a regular manure fork. A half-inch screen, they wouldn't fall through. So what I did was I put this screen on top of a couple of broomsticks with a couple of workhorses, and I rolled it back and forth on the broomsticks while Annabelle shoveled the manure and the sawdust bedding from the floor onto the screen. Well, the bedding fell through as planned, made a nice fluffy pile. The manure stayed on the screen. We dumped it in a bucket, and I decided I can motorize this. I looked around, and I found an old pump motor on a junk pile down the road in a piece of property that we bought. And it was one of these old Sears water pumps with the big pulley on it and the piston that goes back and forth. And I took it home, put it on my workbench, and took the piston off, extended the piston rod, tied it to that screen, put a motor on it, I turned it on, and it shook back and forth at about 400 RPM, which was just right. And I said, yeah, I can do this. Then I went and started mocking one up out of some 2x4s and plywood and tin wheels that I had, bicycle wheels. I put it together, and we took it out in the barn and tried it, and it worked really well. We were as surprised as anybody.
And from this, your company was born.
It's a sole proprietorship. We're not incorporated, and my son-in-law and I are the only people that do the work. He builds them, packs them. I do all of the purchasing parts and design, and I used to do it all, but then I got so that I couldn't really handle it. I can't do it today, but he does it all, and he does a much better job than I ever did.
Well, I got to say, they are absolutely pretty to look at. In fact, I fell in love completely with the other product, which is the worm harvester. I don't even raise worms, and I wanted one. It's such an elegant thing to watch on your website.
My website is www.brockwoodfarm.com. Well, and the worm site, the worm shifter website is www.wormsifter.com.
We were talking a little bit before we were recording, and you mentioned that you had a chance encounter with someone from Norway. You want to tell us about that?
Well, yeah. About 3 years ago, I got a call from Norway. We were sitting down to dinner. His name was Morten Brantsig. Morten has a wife by the name of Siri, and she is an internationally known what we call dressage rider. They have a very, very nice barn, and they get involved in the international competitions. And she has a lot of horse friends in a lot of influential places. They saw the machine, and he wanted to buy one for her. Morten said, well, where can I buy one over here in Europe? And I said, you can't. You can only buy them from me. I said, I would like to have somebody over there. And he said, well, I'd really be interested in that. And I said, well, why don't you buy one first? Then after you've used it for a while, you call me back and let me know if you still want to do it. And maybe we can come up with a licensing agreement that will be amenable to both of us. Sure enough, about 3 months later, he called me up and he said, we would really like to build these over here and make ourselves a family business.
So of the two machines, which one's the bigger seller?
Right now it's 60-40, stall shifter, worm sifter.
There's that much worm raising going on?
It's unbelievable. I never realized it. I had never heard of worm farming until 1912. I'm not that old. Until 2012, when I made the arrangements with the fellow from up in Wisconsin that helped me develop the screen. He was a worm farmer. He came down to see me. And he said, I want to take this stall shifter and make a different screen for it, and I want to sift my worms with it. We worked together and developed a screen. He liked it, and it, again, it's another one of those cases where it worked so well. I said, well, we're going to market it. I told him I would be very, very surprised if we sell more than three or four of these. In the last 24 months, I've sold 60 of them, and I never imagined I would ever sell anywhere near that amount.
Well, and this is not a machine that a backyard worm raiser is going to use. I mean, you have to have real production to use this tool properly and make it pay for itself.
That's true. But if you start a worm farm, worms grow and they produce exponentially. It doesn't take long, maybe 6, 8, 10 months, and you're ready for a worm sifter, because the way they have to sift the worms without the electric model is by hand. With that, they use about a 24-inch square box with a hardware cloth bottom that they just dump into, and then they shake it by hand. And if you can imagine doing that for 8 hours,
yeah,
you can imagine what it'll do to your back. The worm sifter will take a 40-hour job and cut it down to 4 hours.
Well, like I said, I already want one, and I don't even have any worms. It's just such an elegant machine.
I can hook you up with the right people.
Well, I remember the ads in the 70s, you know, the achieve financial independence by raising worms. And frankly, I was skeptical. So I never did go into the worm business.
Well, you should be skeptical, because being in the worm business is like being in the hog business or the cow business. It's animal husbandry. And you've got to take care of those animals every day, 365 days a year. And it's a lot of work, and a lot of people don't realize that when they first get into it. There are three products that you get from worms. The first is worm castings. That's the worm poop. The second is worm cocoons. Those are the eggs. And the third is the worms themselves. So the worm sifter is a three-way separation, and it does it in a single pass for a 3.5-gallon bucket in about 20 seconds.
You know, of course, you can't eat the worms. I mean, so aside from fish bait and other worm farmers, is there a market?
Yeah. The worms are actually, some of them are sold, of course, to as bait worms. And that's a big market in itself. Other worms are sold to start new worm farmers.
And that's like mining the miners, though, right? So you raise worms to sell to other people that will raise worms?
That's it. But castings is the biggest part of the business. Remember, organic gardening is really, really big. And organic gardeners can use worm castings, and they know that there's no GMOs, there's no other chemicals in it. Worm castings, you can't over-fertilize. You can't burn a plant up with them. They're completely composted. And so all the nutrients are there. Tests have been run so many times in so many places where you'll plant a tomato over here with just dirt and water and very little other else than that, and then compare that to the same plant grown with nothing but worm castings, or you can compare it to another plant that may be grown with Miracle-Gro. Now, the Miracle-Gro is going to do a great job, but those are chemicals in that Miracle-Gro.
Right.
And so organic farmers don't want to use that. They can get the same quality plant in production out of worm castings. And now with medical marijuana, wow. They're getting some really great buds.
I did notice that the worm page had a background of what appeared to be marijuana leaves on it. So you're focusing on that market now.
No, I don't focus on it. I thought that was a neat background. I just thought it was a neat background. I was looking for a background, and I wanted something that I could repeat with a bunch of little pictures. And so it's just around the edges.
Yeah. Well, it's an attractive plant. I'll give you that. So, Harry, if we want to get a hold of you, it's through your website. And you've already given us that.
That's basically the only way. And all of my contact information is there. www.brockwoodfarm.com and www.wormsifter.com.
Well, I just absolutely admire the ingenuity of it. And it's such an elegant machine. And who would know, given the purpose of them? And I am someone who's shoveled my share of manure in this life, so I'm looking forward to trying one of your machines.
Well, we've been developing it for 18 years. We started this in 1997, and we've sold over 1,000 of them since then, and we intend to sell a couple thousand more. And hopefully, the project that we got going over in the European Union will expand, and they'll sell a couple thousand over there, and I'll just rake in the royalties.
Congratulations, Harry. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We've been busy here at the Brown County Hour. Not only have we continued to produce the show, we're using all of the dollars so many of you donated to build our new studio at the Brown County History Center. It all begins at the beginning. And after what seemed like months of debate, we've settled on a design we all agree with. It's a simple design that gives us a sound booth that will facilitate making quality recordings of live music in our studio. There's a center wall with a window and two side walls coming into the room at an angle to help support the center. Next came the exciting trips to the big box to forage for usable material. This is a memorable experience many of us have had. Fortunately, after a lengthy search, Rick and I managed to find just enough decent 2x4s to build the sound booth and make it to the checkout counter without knocking over the shelves full of peanuts and candy. Rick, Jeff, and I are seasoned remodelers, and we're leading the charge, but every member of the crew is handy, and we're all pitching in. Rick was able to find some decent used carpet, which saved us some money, so all we had to purchase was the pad. The rest of us have been working on framing the sound booth, and we're just about finished. On the first day, Pam met me at the studio, and we packed in a whole bunch of 2x4s I had previously cut to length. Once we had everything in the studio, we laid out the central wall and fastened the parts together with screws. Pam was pleased to earn her Carpenter's Merit badge, and both of us were pleased to see some progress. The next time we got together, Jeff joined Pam and I, and we assembled the left side wall. When this was completed, we stood up the center wall and braced it so it wouldn't topple over. Then we stood the left wing wall and fastened it to the center wall. Most recently, Pam, Vera, and myself unloaded the sheathing for the sound booth and the insulation to go on the soundproof walls. Then we assembled the right side wall where the entry door will go. About that time, Rick showed up with a load of used carpet, and all of us pitched in to pack it into the studio. When that was finished, we stood up the right side wall and called it a day. In our next work session, Pam, Vera, Jeff, and I cut and fastened the sheathing. Pam and Vera stuffed the recycled denim insulation in the wall cavities, and we began to close up the walls with more sheathing. Jeff has posted some pictures on our Brown County Hour Facebook page, and you can take a look for yourself to see what we've been up to. Now we have more stuff than we have space in the studio, but that's all right, because we have most of what we need to finish the work in the studio at the ready. I would say one more work session will finish out the basic structure, and then we'll be ready for the window and door, and much to our great joy, as soon as the carpet's down, we can move in. This activity is a departure from our normal work of producing a radio show. We're breaking new ground here, and all of us are enjoying the experience. This brings up a good question. What exactly does it take to produce a one-hour radio show? Well, to no one's surprise, it takes more than an hour. We've been displaced for a couple of months since our old studio was demolished, and we've been meeting at what we're tactfully calling Studio B. Our temporary studio is a little harder to find, and we share this space, so our meetings start later than we're used to. We are pleased everyone is still willing to come in and share their music, poetry, and stories. Needless to say, it's their contributions that make the show. This month, we even managed to record the bluegrass band Hamilton Creek in Studio B. So we're getting along just fine. We have big plans for the new studio in the History Center. We're enjoying our new collaboration with them, and we're working with some projects together as the year goes on. Speaking of the History Center, they're planning their first official event. In a strong association with Brown County history, the show is about moonshine. Be sure to check it out February the 21st from 1 to 4 p.m. in the Log Cabin Room. Sometime this spring, we intend to invite each and every one of you to join us for an open house. In the meantime, we'll finish the studio and keep working on the show. Who knew that making radio could involve so much? This is Dave Seastrom with the Brown County Hour. See you next time.
We're going to play an old bluegrass standard called Sitting on Top of the World.
Down, I know where.
And now we pause for station identification.
Brown County Hour is underwritten by Riverlight Yoga, where you will find expert instruction in a completely equipped, newly enlarged studio. We offer a variety of classes with individual instruction a specialty. Gift certificates in any denomination are available. See riverlightyoga.com for full information.
You are listening to the Brown County Hour on volunteer-powered community radio WFHB at 100.7 in Brown County, 91.3 and 98.1 in Bloomington, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at wfhb.org. In our final segment, Don Crum from the Beta Teen Center tells us about the upcoming Youth Showcase musical event, and Rachel Perry shares a tall tale about love and moonshine.
Our own Rick Fettig brings us one of his thoughtful essays, and we close with more music from Hamilton Creek.
On Saturday, February 28th, at the Brown County Playhouse, there is a youth music showcase event. And this evening we have Don Crum, who is the president of Beta Teen Center, to help explain the event and tell us all about it.
Hello, Brown County. I'd like to invite you to the Youth Music Showcase. Proceeds will benefit the Beta Teen Center. The event is on Saturday, February 28, 2015, at the Brown County Playhouse. The show starts at 7:30. Doors open at 6:30. This event is organized and hosted by Kara Barnard. Featured will be Haley Jonet, Maria Sanderson, Sage Walcott, Zelton Kay, and many more. For more information, please go to facebook.com/Beta Teen Center.
My name's Rachel Perry, and I'm going to tell the story of the estrangement of Grandma and Washington Barnes. This story won the third place in the Tall Tale Tell-Off on October 26th. A lot of artists discovered Brown County's paint ability and flocked to the area in 1906. Around that time, an artist couple from Wisconsin showed up at the Pittman Inn in Nashville to spend the summer painting. Most days, the husband, Adolf Schultz, tramped along cow paths and set up his easel to capture picturesque scenes. But his wife, Ada, had other ideas. Noticing apple-cheeked children wading in creeks and sitting on fence rails, she befriended them, filling blank canvases with their sunlit world. Grandma Mary Barnes tended dazzling flower gardens that surrounded her cabin on the east branch of Owl Creek and raised chickens, turkeys, and geese. She hit it off with Ada Schultz, who started bringing selected children to pose with Mary's friendliest fowl. In preparation, Mary hand-fed her feathered charges and fixed jelly sandwiches for the young models. Mary's passion for chickens and turkeys inhibited her taste for cooked fowl, and one turkey in particular had become a special pet. He was king of the roost at the Barnes place, strutting among the hollyhocks. Mary fed her pet turkey salty meat grease to add luster to his feathers and often coaxed him into the house, a habit loudly protested by her husband, Washington. Despite his aversion to the bird, the turkey sought out Wash's company like a cat who senses allergic visitors and jumps into their laps. Well, Mary wasn't immune to a feeling of envy for the immortality conferred upon her subjects of Ada's paintings, and one day suggested that her artist friend might paint a portrait of herself along with her favorite turkey. Despite their close friendship, Ada resisted, preferring to depict the innocence of youth. But she finally gave in and agreed to begin a large canvas in late August, a week before the Schultzes returned to Wisconsin. Mary eagerly anticipated the day. She busied herself restarching her favorite bonnet, mending a flower print dress, and frequently petting the turkey into a stupor to accommodate lengthy poses. While Mary scurried around hoeing, weeding, and carrying water, selling eggs and baby chicks, and scrubbing other people's clothes, her husband, Wash, moseyed about the place. Often sleeping till almost noon, he would then split a few chunks of wood and occasionally make brooms to sell in Nashville. He was known as a slacker among Mary's friends, but his buddies at the Liars Bench in town knew his true reason for sleeping late. In a hollow 2 ridges north of Owl Creek, Wash spent long nights tending his fermenting corn mash. Mary hadn't noticed the absence of her copper kettle that summer, since the canning season had yet to commence. One sticky evening in late August, when the insect symphony was loud enough to override porch banjo picking, Wash started out toward his special project, and Mary's pet turkey began to follow. Thinking that the turkey would make an ideal guinea pig for his latest batch of moonshine, Wash didn't discourage the bird. In fact, when the turkey tired of the hilly terrain and fell back, Wash picked him up and carried the bird under his arm. The turkey amiably chattered and gobbled, weaving his neck up and down, tilting his head to catch all the sights. They arrived at a small clearing where a few logs served as benches, and the fire pit, coil, and moonshine still were carefully concealed under shrubbery. Wash put the turkey down and scooped a little gunpowder from his pouch into a metal cup, pouring his latest hooch into the mix. He grinned with satisfaction as the potion flamed when he held a match to it. He allowed the cup to cool and set it on the ground. The turkey curiously approached the cup and began to drink. He took in a beakful, then tipped back his head while the white lightning trickled down his throat. At first, he shook his head in bewilderment, but then he drank a little more and soon pecked and tipped with merry abandon. When the bird showed no ill effects, Wash settled down to taste his own wares, and the two genially drank as the whippoorwills repeated their insistent whistle. After a while, Wash became aware of distant thunder and rustling in the treetops. Then the black night stuttered with freeze-framed lightning, and he heard the wall of rushing rain before heavy drops thumped his brimmed felt hat. He looked through bleary eyes for the turkey, finally spying him at the clearing edge, wobbling in and out of the bushes, murmuring to himself. The torrential rain fell in sheets, instantly drenching Wash's overalls and filling his boots. Barely able to make out the turkey's shape, he watched in wonder as the turkey gazed up into the sky, beak open. Unable to swallow fast enough to drink the downpour, in a few moments the bird fell over, drowned in the surge. As quickly as the storm had approached, it rumbled away toward Salt Creek Valley, leaving only occasional drips from newly rinsed foliage. Wash nudged the dead turkey with his foot, then picked it up to stagger home through muddy rivulets. The tempest in the forest was nothing compared to the storm Wash Barnes endured when Mary spied him stomping onto the cabin porch, dangling the lifeless bird. She cursed her husband and all of his relatives never to speak to him again. And that's when she drew a line to establish her half of the cabin where he could never again set foot. When Washington Barnes died in his sleep in 1929, the sheriff and coroner had to hoist his body through the bedroom window to comply with Mary's territorial restriction. Grandma Barnes eventually trained another turkey to pose with her for Ada Schultz, but the painting took many years to complete. Titled Companions, the canvas-enhanced exhibitions at the Chicago Galleries Association, as well as the Milwaukee Journal Gallery of Wisconsin Art in 1928.
I see some squirrels almost every day. I have several grays that live in my trees. They're scampering around in the morning as I'm out the door and heading off to work. We don't really get to spend a lot of time together due to scurrying and rushing, but I think I'm going to try to change that. Some people have cats and dogs or hamsters and parrots as pets, and I'll have these squirrels. After all, they're right here, they're free, and they need love too. I'll speak aloud to them, try to get close, and occasionally lay out some nuts and perhaps some field corn. I caught part of a show on PBS the other day about the nature of squirrels and other animals. Did you know that there are white squirrels down in Carolinas? But the part that caught my attention was the mating ritual. The males would squabble and fight until one proved to be dominant over the other. This is typical for many species. The stallion, the bull, many rodents, and the bird with the proudest and most colorful plumage. The female then allows the most dominant male the privilege of mating. This then ensures the survival of the species. It's been similar with humans. Only the strong survive. After the original sin, which brought us out of the strictly animal kingdom, after all, the only animals that might realize that they are naked, perhaps, are the purse-carried chihuahuas or poodles. The female, with her periodic internal clock, excuse the pun, that is syncopated with the moon, she probably realized the concept of time. She also had a need to replenish her iron, and recognized that the male was the better purveyor of meat, so she watched for the better hunter, and in particular, the males who were willing to provide for her and her offspring for the duration of child-rearing. This was a developing progress in humankind. Survival of the species and offspring. After all, with the bigger-headed babies, giving childbirth became a life-or-death endeavor. This ritual has contributed to mankind's survival for generation after generation. Things, they are changing. We no longer have to bring in the grizzly bear and the deer or even the rabbit and squirrel for survival. Our survival is pretty much industrialized at this point. Instead of fire, we have the electric and gas companies. Our food comes off the shelf at the grocery store, the new gathering. Mankind and our survival of the species is much different these days. Do we feed ourselves on genetically modified foods? Do we keep polluting our water supply until all drinking water has to be processed? Do we keep pumping all of our hydraulic fluids and gases out of the inner earth only to burn them off into our atmosphere and thus end up breathing oxygen via masks? My dear female, loved and respected companion on the face of this earth. Selective breeding is as important as ever, but it's not the broadest shoulders or the fastest gun or best spear chucker. It's not the toughest kid on the block or the guy who spreads his seed like a machine gun. You, my female friend, are a special part of the continuation of mankind. With all the control you currently have over procreation, unless you live in Texas, survival of the species is dependent on those who have a lot of love of mankind and those who respectfully practice stewardship over the planet Earth. The squirrels will be squirrels and continue to mate with the one who has the fluffiest tail. Men will always balance along the rail fence, lift the heavy plywood, and show off to prove their masculinity. But girls, with your current influence and strength, no means no. But yes is more important than ever. Livelihood is a team effort. Foster your partnership and have a happy Valentine's Day.
Well, let's try it. Okay. Here we go.
Thank you.
We would like to mention an upcoming event here at the History Center. They're hosting a Brown County Still exhibit on Saturday, February the 21st from 2 to 5 p.m. And who better to provide the musical entertainment than local favorites, the White Lightning Boys. Thanks for tuning in to episode 35 of the Brown County Hour, recorded this month in Studio B in downtown Nashville, and brought to you the first Sunday of every month at 9 a.m. and the following Wednesday at 6 p.m. You can stream this or any of our shows from our website, browncountyhour.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out our Woodwatch page devoted to informing the public of the situation our forest lands are facing. This show was produced by Jeff Foster, Pam Rader, Rick Fettig, Vera Grubbs, and Dave Seastrom. We would also like to thank our friend Slats Klug for our wonderful theme music. You've been listening to the Brown County Hour.
Coming to you from deep in the woods of Brown County, Indiana.
Celebrating the arts, culture, and nature that make this such a unique community.
Visit us online at browncountyhour.com.
The Brown County Hour is a production of WFHB.
Volunteer-powered, listener-supported community radio for South Central Indiana.
Take me back to my home, Brown County home.